From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Even when you take out insurance status and income, the infant mortality rate for Black women is nearly 2.5 times higher than for white women. Minorities are more likely to have feet amputated for late-stage diabetes and less likely to have dialysis, heart medications, and bypass surgery. The Centers for Disease Control says the disparities in health and health care among racial and ethnic minorities are both unacceptable and correctable. And today on the program, we're talking about the problems when it comes to race and health care in America with Michael Byrd, the first Native American to head the American Public Health Association, about possible remedies. Plus, Nora Ephron's trademark wit comes to Salt Lake Acting Company. All that and your calls coming up after the news. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. The leading causes of death for Native Americans include diabetes, chronic liver disease, and suicide, none of which are in the top 6 causes of death for white non-Hispanic men. Although Native Americans are living longer, health disparities remain, as well as in other ethnic groups. And today on the program, we're talking about ways to eliminate ethnic disparities in healthcare. Joining me this hour is Michael Byrd. He has over 25 years of public health experience in the areas of medical social work, substance abuse prevention, health promotion, disease prevention, and behavioral health. He's the first American Indian and social worker to serve as president of the American Public Health Association. He has a master's degree in social work from the University of Utah, a master's degree in public health from UC Berkeley. And today on the program, he's joining us in studio. He's in Salt Lake City. And Michael Byrd, welcome. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, and I'm very happy to be here with you this morning.
Michael Byrd will share his personal and professional journey advocating for marginalized communities during his lecture, Impasse, an American Indian's Reflections on Social Justice. That's happening tonight at 6 o'clock in the College of Social Work at the University of Utah. We'll give you more details on that as we go. Later on in the program, we'll turn to drama. We'll talk about Nora Ephron's charming take on relationships and what to wear, Salt Lake Acting Company's latest endeavor. But first, health disparities. If you're a patient or a nurse or a doctor, why do you think there are such glaring disparities in the health and health care of minority patients? Give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Michael Byrd, we'll get to the host of issues that the public health community has been tackling when it comes to this issue in a moment. But I understand your personal interest in public health really stems from some elements in your own family and your childhood. Tell us, what drew you to the public health arena?
Well, first of all, let me just say, getting to public health, the vehicle to in terms of approaching that was really through social work. I grew up in a family where there were some challenges, some issues. My father had a longstanding history of substance abuse, and that was part of the larger family scenario, unfortunately. And he eventually died of his due to his drinking. And so if you have a family member who's challenged and has that kind of behavior, you don't have a normal childhood, because children have to depend on their parents, the mother and the father. And if you have a father that's, has a problem, has an issue, well, that creates a challenge for the whole family. So, I was aware of the fact that, this was an issue for my family, and felt like I had an appreciation and an understanding, not just on an academic level, but on a personal level, because I had lived this and this had been my experience. So I wanted to, felt that I had something to offer my community, the American Indian community. Of course, as I've grown older and had more experience, I've come to clearly understand that we all have problems. It's just different kinds of problems. And actually, there are a lot of non-Indian people out there who could use a little help. And so I'm happy to be here in Salt Lake to offer my services, because we all have issues. They're just different issues, and we all bring different skills to the situation, to the issue. I've been fortunate because of the opportunities I had through the University of Utah, UC Berkeley, and serving as the first Indian president of APHA, American Public Health Association. And I've had the opportunity to share my perspectives not only locally, but nationally and internationally, working with all communities and all populations. And the challenges that the American Indian population faces are not unlike that of indigenous communities across the globe, be it Canadian Aboriginal people, be it the Maori of New Zealand, be it Australian Aboriginal people, be it indigenous people of South America. Many of the results of contact and inequity and lack of opportunity and exploitation have manifested themselves in the conditions that Native populations now have to deal with. And it's the manifestation of those of contact and inequity and injustice that plays out. And Sir Michael Marmot, a British researcher about 10 years ago, has a body of work, and he's coined the phrase social determinants of health. And that concept, I think, really speaks to the issue, and that is that it's less about one's genetic code, and it really is predicated more on your zip code and where you live and the environment and the circumstances of your environment. And we're talking about things broader than health. We're talking about employment. We're talking about housing. We're talking about transportation. We're talking about access to health care. And those conditions and lack of educational opportunities, those conditions are what create inequities and manifest themselves in health disparities, as well as a host of other disparities. So it's not, you know, people want to say, well, it's about personal choice and people decide. Well, you don't decide who you're born, where you're born, and in that environment. You come into that environment. And, I mean, and there are inequities across the board. I mean, depending on where you live. Do you live on the east side of town? Do you live on the west side of town? Are you on the south side? Which side of the tracks are you on has a great deal to do with what the manifestations in terms of your opportunities for education, your opportunities to access health care, your opportunities for employment, and a whole host of other variables that impact on one's health.
I want to definitely unpack some of the root causes of where we're going with these disparities, but explain what the picture looks like. What are some of the health care disparities that you see right now? Mortality rates, certain diseases, vaccination rates, treatments. I mean, can you give people a sense of how big this problem really is?
Well, it is a very significant problem, and one of the in some research and some activity that I've done in New Mexico, where I live in Bernalillo County, which is the largest county, we did a study on urban Indian populations, and what we came up with was that the average age of death for American Indians in Bernalillo County is 56 years.
Wow!
For all other individuals, all other races, it's 71.
That's one county in America.
That's one county, but by and large, I think it's safe to say that's representative, and probably in some counties it's even worse than that. And I'm speaking of the American Indian population, but it also holds for African American populations, Hispanic Latinos, and poor whites. But that's the experience in New Mexico, and I think it is representative of what American Indians face. And so you should be very happy that I'm here with you today, because I managed to get beyond 56, and so you should be you're blessed by this opportunity to even have me here this morning.
I'm very, very grateful.
And I'm happy to be here, too.
I'm sure you are. Michael Byrd, he has over 25 years of experience in the public health arena, a former president of the American Public Health Association, and he's speaking in Salt Lake City tonight about the impasse and American Indians' reflections on social justice. That, again, is happening tonight, September 13th, 6 to 8 p.m., in the Okazaki Meeting Room of the College of Social Work at the University of Utah. If you'd like to join our conversation, we're talking about disparities in healthcare when it comes to race and ethnic groups. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. So this issue has certainly been on the radar of the National Institutes of Health, the Centers for Disease Control. I mean, it's been part of the national discussion for years. Why is it so hard to remedy health disparities among these ethnic groups? Michael Byrd, what do you think?
Well, in my own personal opinion, I think that, it is a longstanding issue. President Nixon back in the 70s spoke to the fact that for American Indian populations, and again, this holds for across the board, but that American Indians had the longest and the most significant disparities, be it economic, be it social, whatever. And so it's been acknowledged, it's been recognized, but I mean, in order to address these issues, you have to have, I think, resources. And in this day and age when we're talking about deficits and we're engaged militarily in military operations across the globe, that's resources. And so it has not been a priority, I believe, for this nation to deal with those issues. There are people who are working day in and day out to address the issue, but you need not only political rhetoric, and you need a moral and a social consciousness and a will to address these issues, and it's been lacking. One example is with the American Indian population. There was a report done about, I think it was about 10 years ago, that looked at funding for American Indian populations, per capita funding, and there was more funding going for the care of federal prisoners than there is for the health care for American Indian populations. So that, I mean, all you have to do is, I mean, the evidence is there. All you have to do is look at the evidence in terms of studies that have been done, the research that's been done, and I think it's really a tragedy, because the most important resource we have in this country, in my opinion, are the people. And if you want a healthy nation and if you want a strong nation, you have to invest in your people. And that means all people, because that's the foundation of social justice and equity and fairness and democratic principles.
Speaking with Michael Byrd, a public health expert, sharing his perspectives on the disparities in healthcare among racial groups. 801-355-TALK is our number. Let's go to the phones, and Raymond is joining us from Salt Lake City. Raymond, hi.
Hi. I appreciate the opportunity to voice comments and questions, but I agree 100% with the professor. And I would characterize it as social snubbing. I know exactly what he's referring to, but historically, if you go back to, it becomes criminal servitude. If you look at when the blacks were emancipated after the Civil War, they really were not emancipated. What they did is they created laws to jail them and force them into criminal servitude. And this still exists today. Cultures are socialized that way. I've experienced that, and I understand 100% when he says zip code. Sometimes it's like getting off on the wrong road on the freeway. I just wanted to support his position. Thank you very much.
Raymond, thank you very much for the call. I want to get your response to that, Michael Byrd, but we need to take a short break right now. We're talking about healthcare in America, how race and ethnicity fit into this picture. We're speaking with Michael Byrd. He's a public health expert. He'll be sharing his personal and professional journey advocating for marginalized communities this evening in a lecture titled Impasse and American Indians Reflections on Social Justice. That's happening tonight, September 13th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the University of Utah. If you'd like to join our conversation, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. By so many measures, healthcare is failing ethnic minorities in this country, from suicide rates among Native Americans to infant mortality among African Americans to diabetes rates among Hispanics. There are huge gaps in the health and healthcare of minorities in America. Today on the program, we're talking about how to tackle those disparities with Michael Byrd. He's a public health expert. He's speaking tonight at the University of Utah's College of Social Work. We'll give you details on that lecture as we go. But Michael Byrd, before the break, we got a call from Raymond in Salt Lake City talking about the situation. He compared healthcare of to blacks in the South in previous days. I mean, I guess my question to you is, what role is bigotry and racism playing in the disparity issue when it comes to healthcare?
Well, I think it's one that people are uncomfortable dealing with, but some of us, it's part of our, the reality of our experience, more day to day in many cases. It's real clear to me. Well, one of the things, for example, in speaking specifically to American Indian populations, is the fact that there has been no population whose lives have been more dictated to and impacted by the federal government in terms of federal policy. And this federal policy has really, oftentimes, federal policy has really been a disservice to Indian populations, disempowering them, removing them from their resources, denying them really freedom to take control of their own lives and the resources to provide for their families and their communities. So it is a larger issue, of which one part of it, I think, is racism, is discrimination. There are, I remember the days when people used to say, well, if you go get an education, Mike, go get an education, you know, establish who you are and what you are, and there'll be a place for you. Well, I've done all that, and there are places where the doors open, and there are places where the doors are slammed shut. Because people do not, it really, the issue is about power and privilege and who controls the agenda. And people have an idea of what it is that Indian people need. And God forbid there should be an Indian that actually knows something about it and has credentials, has experience, has been successful. And why would we want him, why are we going to invite him to the table? Because he may offer something, he's going to tell us something that we may not want to hear. Because we're the experts, we know what Indian people need, and that's been the whole history of Indian people and many other populations, is that somebody else thinks they know more about, in this case, somebody. I've had this happen, and it's out there, people who think they know more about Indians than Indians. I'm Indian. I've been an Indian for almost 61 years. I've been in public health for about 30 years, so I think that gives me a little bit of an advantage when it comes to issues impacting my community and coming up with solutions. And I think that the reality is that there are those of us out there, and there are people working to address these issues, and there are communities. So I don't want to be totally negative about this, because there is an upside and a downside to everything. And there are many Indian communities who are confronting the issues that we're speaking to this morning, and they're grappling with them, they're recognizing them, and they're doing as much as they can to try and change some of these trends. But what they need are people who are supportive, people who really want to step up and not just talk, but people who want to roll up their sleeves and do something. And that requires work, and that requires resources, and that requires a real commitment.
You mentioned earlier in our conversation about access to healthcare. I'm wondering how much of this is an economic issue. Is it people don't have access to healthcare? They may not have health insurance. They may not have the financial resources to go to the doctor on a regular basis and do that prevention side, which would help on the other side of a disease. I mean, how much of the economic part of this is the disparity?
Well, it is an economic issue. If you don't have the resources and you don't have the services and the programs in communities, then people can't access and get the care that they need. You have to invest in these systems, and you have to ensure that these systems are open and responsive to the needs of the community. I spent 20 years in the Indian Health Service, and it was the best of times. It was the worst of times. We had systems, but we sometimes, in many cases, and unfortunately, I hate to say this even today, you have these systems in place, but you don't have providers. If you don't have the leadership, the moral leadership, and the real commitment to community, you will have providers that are not open, are not committed to the community, and may not understand not engage the community in ways that are effective, and are not culturally competent, are not linguistically competent, and really don't understand the population. The whole thing with working with any community, and specifically in American Indian communities, if you're going to work with them, you need to know something about the history of what happened. And unfortunately, in this country today, most people, it's like coming into a movie when the movie's half over. And so their lack of understanding, I mean, is very limited as to why these conditions exist on reservations and urban communities. Why is it that these people are in these conditions? Well, if you don't study some history, if you don't study federal policy as it relates to what's happened to American Indian people, you're not going to understand the context. And the context and the history is everything.
Mm. So you think that medical schools and nursing colleges and all the people who are training the next generation of doctors and nurses could do a better job on the cultural sensitivity front?
They need to do a better job. I mean, if they want to be effective, if they're professional and they want to be effective, and I think they do, and if they want to make a difference, part of that is knowing the people and the community and the history of those people so that you can be effective. It's not enough to just assume, well, you know, I've learned everything. I've got my PhD. I've got my master's. I've got my MD, and I'm the source of all knowledge. It doesn't work. You have to also meet people where they're at. You have to understand the community. You have to understand the reality of people's day-to-day lives, of the fact that there are challenges that you probably, you're privileged if you can be in college. You're privileged if you can get through and have credentials. People in many of these communities don't have those opportunities and that privilege. And you assume, many people assume that everybody has the same opportunities, and that quite clearly is not a fact.
Mm. Speaking with Michael Bird, he's a public health expert, former president of the American Public Health Association. He's speaking tonight at the College of Social Work. The title of his lecture is Impasse, an American Indian's Reflections on Social Justice. And there's more on our website, kcpw.org. You mentioned that you need to know the context. Providers need to have a better sense of the history and the richness of a culture before trying to administer help. But you also said that some of the solutions need to come from within. I'm wondering, are the various ethnic communities, I mean, are they tackling disparities head on from within?
In my experience, yes, and particularly with the American Indian population, American Indian, Alaska Native, Native Hawaiian population of who I've worked with, they recognize the nature and extent of disparities because we live that. It's our families and family members who we see not, as I mentioned, the mortality data, not living full productive lives because of some sort of medical condition, some chronic condition. And yeah, no, we live this, so we know what it is. I think that the level of understanding of what we can do in terms of health education and health promotion and disease prevention, some of those concepts are things that we wrestle with because of the lack of access to education, employment, housing, transportation, and all of these multiple factors that impact a community. It is not simple. It is not easy. But we are moving and have moved to having a better grasp and a better understanding of what is adversely impacting our communities.
Mm-hmm. As I mentioned, though, I mean, this has been on the radar for years. Any improvement? And if there is improvement, where? What is working?
Well, One of the things that's working, and I see, is particularly in the Indian Health Service, not so much with the Indian Health Service, but with Indian tribes. Many of the tribes, under Public Law 93-638, which is a law that came about during President Nixon's administration, allows tribes to contract, to compact, and to take over their own health programs. And there's been an increase in the number of tribes across the country that have taken control of their own health systems. And by and large, what we see in terms of the research indicates that they're having better outcomes for their communities. The other movement I see is in urban communities with urban populations. You see a number of urban health centers across the country, Seattle, San Francisco, Denver, and many of these metropolitan areas, which federal policy actually brought them under relocation and to try and get Indians off the reservations and so that we could be assimilated, and it really didn't work because there's still Indians in urban centers and they still get together and they still have culture and exchange in Indian centers and Indian health centers. But the point is that they've created a system to meet their needs. But it's all uphill. I mean, it's not a level playing field. They've had to create these things. They've had to advocate. They've had to, you know, really create something where there was nothing and create something where the existing systems that were there were not open, not responsive, and not helpful.
And the resources are not often there.
Right.
So we've got some grassroots movement. I mean, what more needs to be done? What's left on the agenda?
Well, it would be nice in a nation that is busy promoting democracy across the globe if we could put some resource and honor the commitments and the obligations that the nation made to American Indian tribes and the first people of this country. Treaties were made, promises were made to provide health care and education and an array of other programs to American Indian people. I think one can clearly make the case that those and it was an exchange. Resources, land was given up, taken, and there were promises that this country made to Indian populations that they would provide this. Well, the record really clearly demonstrates when we have the worst health disparities in this country and some of the highest poverty rates and highest dropout rates, that something's not working. And I would contend that one part of this is that the promise has never been fulfilled.
Hmm. You've written that we have disparities, but we are much more than that. So it's not a matter of just looking at all the negatives, but of recognizing the positives as well. What do you see is the silver lining in this discussion about disparities? I mean, where are the areas of improvement? What particular strengths do you think you can build on?
Well, first of all, I mean, there are a lot of different sort of ideas that the general society takes from Indian people, concepts, theories, ways of looking at the world, and then somebody packages it and sells it as their idea. And here's two examples. One is, first of all, the concept of holistic health did not come from, it is a concept that is very much an indigenous theme and an indigenous concept. Mind, body, spirit didn't come from Europe. That is where you had a mechanical sort of approach to things. That sort of concept, Andrew Weil, and God bless Andrew Weil for his marketing and passionating and promoting mind, body, spirit sort of approaches to healing. But, you know, I mean, it's not his idea. It came from other populations and other communities. It really is an indigenous from native populations. It's a part of Eastern philosophy. And that's really the seed of where that all came from. So it's sort of like, you know, you've gone full circle and oftentimes not acknowledged the source of that knowledge and that wisdom and where that came from. Another example is the whole concept of running. And running as a vehicle for promoting people's health. Running didn't start with Jim Fix. And I know he's been gone for a while, but some of us who are a little older remember him. But it didn't start with Jim Fix. It didn't start with Kenneth Cooper. Running has an ancient history in the Americas, both North and South. And I've actually developed a documentary that and written articles that speak to that, about the value. And running is more than just a physical activity. It is a metaphor for many things. And so that there are things that we have. I mean, concepts of health in terms of nutrition and diet, many of these things, if you go back to the source, many of these concepts and ideas which were healthy, and I mean, Indian people would not have survived. I mean, in New Mexico, we've been there 10 to 30,000 years. We obviously have been doing something right in spite of everything that we've been, all the adversity. Indian people would not be here on this continent, have survived as much as we've survived, had we not clearly had some things of value and some things that have promoted, supported, and allowed our communities to continue. So that's just one example. I mean, there are many. Virgil Vogel's American Indian Medicine, University of Oklahoma Press, talks about Indian perspectives on healing, and many of the concepts are knockoffs of what he promoted and he wrote about. Hmm.
Our time is short, but just finally, how important is the awareness part of this issue of disparities among ethnic groups? How important is that education part in finding solutions?
Well, education is critical. It creates a better understanding of what we're dealing with. It creates a little aging helps things too. I mean, I'm back here, and I graduated from U and 35 years ago, my degree in social work. Let me tell you, I see the world in a much different way. I'm real clear on the things that impact our communities on a micro level, but also on a macro level. And when you create policies that support health, promote health on a state, a local, a state, and a federal level, that can make a difference for promoting the health of populations, or it can impact populations negatively as well. And so you need all of that. You need to understand what it is you're dealing with in terms of community programs. Are they effective? Do they make a difference? Are they having positive outcomes for those communities? But on a larger level, are the people who are making the decisions, do they understand those communities? Do they understand when they're passing a bill, when they're passing legislation, when they're out there, do they really understand what the impact of their decisions are? And in many cases, when it comes to ethnic populations, when it comes to American Indian populations, they don't know those populations. So how can they do the right thing? And so I would challenge them to have a, and it's, and we're not, it, you know, we're talking about minority and ethnic problems. People got to wake up. We're not, the minority is the new majority. And in some cases, in New Mexico, in California, and a lot of states, we're not numerically, statistically, the minority. So people better start paying attention to our issues and our concerns as well, because it benefits everyone.
Michael Bird, a public health expert. He's speaking tonight at the University of Utah's College of Social Work. His lecture is titled Impasse and American Indians Reflections on Social Justice. Again, tonight, September 13th at 6 o'clock at the University of Utah. Michael Bird, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up next, Salt Lake Acting Company's Love, Loss, and What I Wore. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. What do you get when you mix Nora Ephron's trademark wit and 80 local women? Well, a lot of laughs, some poignant insight, and a fun-filled fundraiser for Salt Lake Acting Company. Today on the program, we're talking about Salt Lake Acting Company's production of Love, Loss, and What I Wore. It's a series of staged readings written by the sisters Nora and Dahlia Ephron, and featuring some of Utah's most distinguished women, or notorious women. I'm I'm not sure which one of those, and I only say that because I'm part of it. Joining me in studio is Cynthia Fleming and Kevin Myrie. They are executive producers at Salt Lake Acting Company. Welcome back, Cynthia, Kevin. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Jennifer. Good to see you this morning.
And also with us, Donna Weinholz. She is an activist, a whirling dervish, self-proclaimed, and she's also part of the production. Donna, welcome to you.
Thank you so much. Good morning.
Salt Lake Acting Company presents these stage readings of Love, Loss, and What I Wore. It's opening tonight, right?
Yes.
September 13th.
And I'm on tonight. It's
Woo!
My night.
It's your debut. It's running through September 30th, Wednesdays through Sundays at Salt Lake Acting Company. That's 168 West, 500 North in Salt Lake City. You can call them at 801-363-SLACK, or you can visit saltlakeactingcompany.org for more information and for tickets. And if you would like to join our conversation, if you've got questions or comments about the production, you can email us at cityviews@kcpw.org. Kevin Myrie, I'll start with you. We marked the passing of Nora Ephron, who raised the bar for all romantic comedies in this country. She wrote this piece with her sister. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about the collaboration.
Well, it was from a book that is part pictures and part just like little essays that Ilya had written about her journey through her life of clothes. And so Nora and Dilya, what they have done is just expanded it beyond the book. They include various ones from the book, but then they have various other women's monologues that they've included, like Rosie O'Donnell's one of them as well. And so they've incorporated it into just a fun evening for girls' night out at the theater.
That sounds great. Cynthia Fleming, the script weaves these stories of, is it five or six women?
Five.
Five women, their observations on purses and on divorce and the fashion sense of Madonna. Give us just the basic gist of the play.
Well, what for me, after I read the play, I never realized that we do make these stories every time we look in our closet. We see a piece of clothing and go, and you want to wear, oh, no, I can't wear that because I, you know, I had a terrible time at that party, I wish I could fit into that. And then one thing I love about Nora Ephron is how she articulates women and says the unspoken, like why we do things, why we feel things, how everything came about. And it has really shaped my life, and I'm in my 50s now. I just kind of, it's like, it's almost coming full circle. But these dresses, as she says in this play, tell a story, and it ends up being a story of this, of Gingy's life in the play.
Mm. Donna, who's your character?
I'm Gingy's mother.
Gingy's mother, that's a great character.
Yes.
Do you have a favorite moment in the reading?
I think probably my favorite moment comes when the discussion about the blue robe takes place, because I've had to read it several times so that I won't cry on stage. Everyone who knows me knows that I always say, well, I cry at grocery store openings, so you can absolutely imagine what happens when I have to say something like, you know, the only thing I remember about my mother is a blue robe. And it's pretty intense.
I mean, Nora Ephron is certainly known for her comedic timing, her acerbic wit. And so there are many funny moments in this play, but there are also some poignant ones, some serious ones.
Yes.
Cynthia Fleming.
Yeah, I had the exact same thing when there's a couple moments. Well, when at the end of the play, when Gingy says, after she gives a book of all these the dresses to her children, she says, I want them to know I was more than their mother. I was a girl. I just like, you know, so I've had to keep reading it because I don't want to do that.
It's so true. Yeah.
We're speaking with Cynthia Fleming and Kevin Myrie, executive producers of Salt Lake Acting Company. Also with us, Donna Weinholz. And we're talking about some staged readings that will open tonight, September 13th, at Salt Lake Acting Company. The production is titled Love, Loss, and What I Wore. It's running through September 30th at Slack. You can go to saltlakeactingcompany.org for tickets and for more information. Kevin, this is a fundraiser for Slack. And this time you're doing something pretty interesting, pretty fun. You invited 80 women locally to participate in the readings. Since you invited me to be part of that, you recruited a lot of people who don't know anything about acting.
No, and the idea was after read this play a couple of years ago and thought that it would be a good just play to do at Salt Lake Acting Company for our audience. And then Cynthia and I were at this dinner last fall of just randomly, actually, of artists and scientists. And it was just so great to cross paths with people outside your normal day of life. And so then when started to approach this, well, wouldn't it just be great to have as many women cross-section that we can get together and have them in the same room together?
And so when you extended this, you know, cast the net out and extended invitations, how do people react to you?
You know, most of them was, well, I'm not an actress.
There you go.
You know, that was usually the first thing out. Some of them said the first thing was, I've always wanted to be an actress and would love to do it. But most people, it to get up on stage in front of 100 people is a terrifying experience no matter how many times you do it. And that's what all these women have reacted to, was getting over that fear and putting themselves in front of an audience.
Oh, not unless you were born to the stage, darling.
There Sorry. You go, Donna. I don't know. I mean, I have butterflies, and I am having a lot of angst over what I'm going to wear on stage. So
yes.
If you want to come and see me, you can find out. That's I'm going to be in the Friday, September 28th production. Donna will be in the Friday, September 21st production. Yes. And should we give people a taste of what this sounds like? Ladies?
Sure.
Sounds like fun.
I first want to say Kevin and I are just thrilled with these women. They all volunteered their time for Salt Lake Acting Company. So thank you, thank you, thank you.
Well, Salt Lake Acting Company has a prominent place in this community. So I hope you don't regret your decision to invite me.
Let's
give listeners a sense of the pacing and some of the comedic moments. Cynthia, set this one up for us.
Well, there's a lot of different stories in this play that you'll hear. And then all of a sudden, there's about three or four clothesline that it's called. Mm-hmm. And it's just sayings, quotes. And this one is called Clothesline, What My Mother Said.
All right. This is from Love, Loss, and What I Wore. Don't wear stripes and prints together.
Loafers ruin your feet.
Stop tugging at your crotch, Samantha.
If you wear a girdle, you will destroy your stomach muscles.
Always wear clean underpants in case you die in a car accident.
You never wear that dress. Do you know how much I paid for it?
Never buy a red coat.
I saw your friend Stephanie at the mall. Is she wearing the blouse I bought you?
Go right back upstairs and take that off.
Nice Jewish girls don't get their ears pierced.
You'd be so pretty if you...
Lost weight.
Gained weight.
Didn't make faces.
Fixed your nose.
Cut your hair.
Combed your hair.
Washed your hair.
Kept your hair out of your eyes.
Stood up straight.
Ate fruit.
Put on a little lipstick.
Took off all that makeup.
Ah, honey, you look so beautiful.
Just looking at you, I'm going to cry.
My little baby is all grown up.
You're so pretty.
Do you know how pretty you are?
You're pretty enough for normal purposes.
Is that what you're wearing?
Are you wearing that deliberately to annoy me?
Never wear white before Memorial Day.
Never wear white after Labor Day.
Never wear white.
You're much too young to wear black.
Never wear black pants with a white shirt or you'll look like the caterer's help.
Never wear velvet before Rosh Hashanah.
What did you do to your hair?
Is that a tattoo?
If you wear that, you're going to be sent home for breaking the dress code.
Take that off. You look like a slut.
You look like a prostitute.
You look like a gypsy.
You look like a bag lady.
You look like a waitress in a Hungarian restaurant.
I don't understand. You could look so good if you tried.
I don't know why I buy you things.
A tiara? You want a tiara? Where are you planning to wear a tiara?
Your bra strap is showing. What do you mean it's supposed to show? That's just a taste of Love, Loss, and What I Wore. Thank you, ladies, very much for that. It's going to be a fun night.
Too fun.
Kevin, this is a fundraiser. How much are you hoping to raise?
We're hoping to raise $25,000, and we're well on the way to that. So we thank the community for their support of buying tickets to this event. Also, in the program at the theater, we've asked the women to describe who they are in one line and then what their article favorite article of clothing and why.
So what kind of answers?
So I mean, yours, Jennifer, I mean, chocolate brown boots, and they're stylish, versatile, and reflect the independence of American West, and they hide my heel. My ankles.
There you go.
But I mean, it's such a revealing thing of what people chose. Cynthia, go ahead.
Well, I chose when I was 3 years old, my grandma Fidel had a beautiful white sweater with flowers on it, and my grandmother Hinnand would knit, so she made me one. And I lived a block away from my grandmother Hinnand, and I lived 2 miles away from my grandma Fidel. And so she made me this sweater, and I just felt so beautiful, just like my other grandma. And I told my mom, see, in those days, you could get out of the house when you're two, you know. I said, I'm going to go to grandma and show her my sweater. And I walked 2 miles by myself at three to show her the sweater.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Donna, what's your story?
And what's my story? Uh-oh. How long have you got?
Favorite item of clothing.
Oh, yes. Back to that. Shoes, and more shoes. I mean, Eva Longoria once said, you know, I am a Latina. I can do aerobics in high heels. And I'm like, you go, girl, because I feel the same way. And believe me, at my age, in my 50s, my feet are definitely showing the signs of those shoes where your foot and your toe go straight down and your heel goes straight up and you walk like a duck, but you got on the best shoes on the planet. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, funny, but now she wears these,
provided by Liberty Mutual.
So she now wears these high heels. They're like, are they wedges or something?
They're platforms.
Platforms. Yeah. So now her foot is flat, but it's like 10 inches above the ground.
Yeah. My husband always says I misrepresented myself when he met me because he thought I was 5'10". And I'm like, well, it's too late now.
Donna Weinholz and Kevin Myrie, Cynthia Fleming, all involved in the upcoming production of Love, Loss, and What I Wore from the Salt Lake Acting Company. Thank you all very much. Break a leg out there.
Thank you.
You too. Break a leg. Yes, and Donna.
And good luck with all your on-air fundraising going
on. Oh, thanks. We need it.
Tis the season.
Tis the season. Yes. Salt Lake Acting Company opens tonight with Love, Loss, and What I Wore. That's happening September 13th through September 30th, Wednesdays through Sundays at Salt Lake Acting Company, 168 West, 500 North in Salt Lake City. You can visit saltlakeactingcompany.org for tickets and for more information. Again, Donna will be featured in the September 21st performance. I'll be there on the 28th. Thanks, guys, very much.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
City Views is a production of KCPW in Salt Lake City. Our technical director is Jesse Ellis. Ryan Cron composed our theme music. And coming up tomorrow, it's Politics Up Close with Jeff Robinson. He'll be joined by the Republican in the race for Salt Lake County Mayor, Mark Crockett. So join us for that. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.